Friends can be brutal. Not just cruel, downright brutal. The dictionary defines brutal as extremely cruel, unfeeling in manner or speech, harsh, vicious, savage. You ever had a friend that attacked you like that and you walked away thinking, wow, what a savage attack? Well, that's what Job experienced. Now, if you've been with me as we've been going through the book of Job, you know that he has three friends. They came to comfort him and did everything but. As the speeches continue, they get more and more brutal. So we've come to the second speech of the third friend, Zophar. Let me tell you what some others have said about what we're going to look at tonight. One pastor said, Zophar is the most brutal of Job's three friends. He doesn't just criticize Job passively. He gives every appearance of enjoying criticizing his friends. He goes after him with a zeal that is hard to comprehend. End of quote. Another said, this is the sixth speech by Job's companions, and it is the most stinging of all the diatribes. Infuriated and insulted, Zophar blasts Job, seeking to convince him that his wealth had vanished because that is what happens to those who deprive the poor. This speech must have hurt Job more than any that his friends had given so far. Zophar was brutal in his attack. He continued the theme of the fate of the wicked that Eliphaz and Bildad had emphasized. However, whereas Eliphaz stressed the distress of the wicked and Bildad their trapped position, Zophar elaborates on the fact that the wicked lose their wealth. He has nothing new to say, but he says it passionately. Now, all of them have observed the simple little truth that this is the speech that gets downright brutal. Now, as we've seen in the other speeches, first there is the speech by the friend, and then there is this answer by Job. So let's look again at the friend, and then we'll see Job's response, and in the process, see what we can learn from both of them. It begins in Job chapter 20, where Zophar says, therefore, my anxious thoughts make me answer. Because of the turmoil within me. Now, to understand this verse, you need to see that it starts with the little word, therefore. It's based on what Job has said at the end of chapter 19. Zophar has been listening to Job. And when Job gets done, he says, in essence, I am really upset with you. And so I must answer you. This is not a calm reflection. He is seething with anger because of the things Job said about him and the other two friends. So he says in verse 3, I have heard the rebuke that reproaches me, and the spirit of my understanding causes me to answer. As you'll recall, Job rebuked them because of what they were saying. So Zophar is starting out by saying, I heard it. I heard you rebuke me. And I'm telling you, I don't like it just a little bit. Namely, that you thought we should expect the wrath and judgment of God. How dare you? Well, you can see he feels a little strongly about this. That's his introduction. What follows is his speech. As I looked at this passage, I thought, it's almost like there are two boxers in a ring. And Zophar is throwing all the punches, and he throws one punch right after the other. And he is just, well, I don't know any other way to say it. He's just brutal. So I'm going to go through this passage. I'm going to tell you his point, and then I'm going to read the verse. For example, look at verse 4 and verse 5. His point is, the joy of the wicked is brief. So he says, do you not know this of old, since man was placed on the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment? Aren't you aware that wicked people don't have joy that lasts very long? Now you can see the application to Job. You're suffering because you're wicked. That's his point. Only this time he's appealing to tradition, which we have seen happen before. Well, as long as men have been on this planet, we know that. So you ought to wake up, Job, and realize that that's what's going on in your life. Now, what he is saying is simply not true. Wicked men sometimes live a long time. Remember the story of Noah? He lived during a time when the whole world was wicked for 120 years. Everybody on the planet was wicked for 120 years, except for 8 people. Or, you'll recall the book of Genesis again, God gave the wicked Canaanites 400 years before he judged them. So, Zophar's thesis is just all wrong, but he's hurling it like a punch in Job's gut. The next thing he says is, and on top of that, the proud perish. Look at verse 6. Though the haughtiness mounts up to the heaven and his head reaches to the clouds, yet he will perish forever like his own refuge. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? And again, you can't help but understand that this is directed toward Job. He's accusing him of being proud and arrogant. And his point is, proud people perish. They don't last forever. He continues that thought in verse 8. He will fly away like a dream and not be found. Yes, he will be chased away like a vision at night. The point being, he's going to perish. It's going to not last long. The same thing is echoed in verse 9. The eye that saw him will see him no more, nor will his place behold him any more. Again, the point is, the proud will perish. So he's saying, if the wicked have any joy at all, well, that's brief, and those proud, wicked people are going to perish. The next thing he says is, the children of the wicked will perish, or will suffer at least. Look at chapter 20, verse 10. The children will seek the favor of the poor, and his hand will restore his wealth. In other words, the children of the wicked will be so bad off, they're going to have to beg from poor people to survive. And then he says, the vigor of the wicked will die. He's now talking about the wicked in verse 11 when he says his bones are full of youthful vigor, but it will lie down with him in the dust. Just when the wicked man is full of his youthful vigor, it will die with him. To say that a person dies young because he is wicked is simply not true. There have been many godly men who died young. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, that famous Baptist preacher of the 18th century, died when he was 53. David Brainerd, one of the most famous missionaries who ever lived, died when he was only 29. Eric Liddell, the star of the Chariots of Fire, won the Olympic medal, died when he was 33. So your whole thesis is wrong. It's not that the wicked die young. And then he makes the point that it is the sin of the wicked that kill him. Verse 12, though evil is sweet in his mouth, and he hides it under his tongue, though he spare it and does not forsake it, but still keeps it in his mouth, yet his food in his stomach turns sour. It becomes a cobra of venom within him. In other words, the wicked man's sin may be sweet. He may savor its sweetness under his tongue to prolong its pleasure. But when it hits his stomach, it'll turn sour, becoming poison. It'll become a deadly poison. And on top of all of that, he's going to lose his riches. Verse 15, he swallows down riches and vomits them up again, God casting them out of his belly. You got to hand it to him. He is vivid, isn't he? Just imagine swallowing your riches and vomiting them back up. It's his riches that'll kill him. He will suck the poison of cobras. The viper's tongue will slay him. What the wicked man swallows will not only vomit him up, but it's a poison that will kill him. He will not see the streams, the rivers flowing with milk, honey and cream. By the way, a land flowing of milk and honey and butter is in the scripture the highest imagery of prosperity and happiness. Remember the children of Israel taken to the land of milk and honey. What he's saying here is the wicked are not going to see that kind of prosperity. He'll not enjoy his riches. Verse 18, he will restore that from which he has labored and will not swallow it down from the proceeds of business. He will get no enjoyment. Verse 19, for he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has violently seized a house which he did not build. The reason for all of this is that this wicked man has oppressed and forsaken poor people, violently seizing their houses. Apparently, Job's friends could not produce any proof of Job's guilt. So the best Zophar could do was accuse him of land grabbing and oppressing the poor. But there's no evidence that Job did anything like that. Matter of fact, the evidence that we have would suggest the very opposite. So the wicked man will have no peace, verse 20, because he knows no quietness in his heart. He will not save anything he desires. His prosperity will not last. He says in verse 21, nothing is left for him to eat. Therefore, his well-being will not last. He'll be miserable, verse 22. In his self-sufficiency, he will be in distress. Every hand of misery will come upon him, and he will be judged. Verse 23, when he is about to fill his stomach, God will cast him on him the fury of his wrath, and it will rain upon him while he is eating. Continues that thought in verse 24. He will flee from the iron weapon. A bronze bow will pierce him through. He's picturing God's judgment as being pierced through with an arrow. It is dawn and it comes out of the body. Yes, the glittering point comes out of his gall. Terror comes upon him. The arrow will be drawn out of the quiver and pierced through his body. It'll terrify him. So total darkness is reserved for his treasure. An unfanned fire will consume him. Shall go ill with him who is left in his tent. The heavens will reveal his iniquity and the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart and his goods will flow away in the day of God's wrath. This is the position from God for a wicked man, the heritage appointed to him by God is for the wicked. So, the whole thing that Zophar is saying can be summed up like this. He He asserts that the joy of the wicked is brief. The proud perish, his children suffer, his vigor will die, his sin will kill him, he will lose his riches. Matter of fact, it's his riches that will kill him. He will not enjoy his riches, he will not have peace, his property will not last, and he will be miserable because God is going to judge him. So with anger, so far passionately asserts, the wicked experience calamity because of the judgment of God. Now, throughout this book, so far, that has been the underlying thesis of all of his friends. Zophar just delivers it with more passion. He's more brutal than the others. He denounces Job because he's saying, you're wicked, and the proof of that is you're suffering, because wicked people suffer, righteous people don't suffer. Therefore, you're wicked, and God is judging you. Now, I say that's pretty brutal. Would you agree with that? So what do we learn from this? Well, seems to me that one of the things that we should learn from this, and there are several, the first is rather obvious, is that if you're going to go visit somebody to comfort them, don't be brutal. That's like saying the obvious, isn't it? Zophar increases his torment by insisting that God is the source of Job's affliction. After a brief rebuke of Job, he drives a long discourse on a single topic, the certain evil fate of every evildoer. He is rejecting Job's assertion that God will appear as his redeemer to vindicate him. He counters Job's statement of confidence by saying the heavens and the earth will stand as witness against the evildoer, even against Job. In his view, Job's hope is false, and he is deluding himself. So I am simply saying, that's brutal, and you ought not be brutal. Now, there's a place for correction, but as I've stated in this series so far, if you must correct somebody, at least be gentle. Zophar was just brutal. I have a second suggestion. I think I would state it like this. You should speak up and shut up. The book of Ecclesiastes says, there's a time to speak and there's a time to be silent. Now, if you think somebody is out of line and feel that it's necessary and appropriate to tell them so, then do it. But keep in mind, this is the, how many times have we gone through this? I mean, this is just brutal stuff. So it seems to me that at some point, after three people have gangbanged him, you ought to just back off. There comes a time when you just need to shut up. I don't know if there's a nicer way to say it. Speak up when that's appropriate, but don't beat the guy to death. Shut up. Let me give you an illustration of this. In 1 Peter chapter 3, Peter addresses wives who have an unsaved husband. And here's what he says. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of the wives. Now, this verse bears some analysis. He does not obey the word. The term word is used in the New Testament of the gospel. It's used in other senses, but it's used of the gospel. So when it says he does not obey the word, it means he doesn't obey the command to believe in Jesus Christ. That means he has heard the message. He had to hear it, not to obey it, right? And so apparently he heard it and rejected it. Now what do you do? Well, the rest of the verse says that you can win him without a word. Now we're talking, the term word is used of you talking. So without a word, now be silent. You can win him, Peter says. You may, it doesn't say will, you may, by the conduct of the wives. When I became a Christian, there was only one translation that was allowed. There were only two, I think, on the market. The King James and the Revised Standard. Now, we got so many, they got more translations than you got fingers and toes. But I grew up on the King James Version. And the King James Version of 1 Peter 3:1 says, they can be won by the conversation of the wives. That is the exact opposite of what this verse says. In 1611, when the King James was translated, conversation actually meant conduct, not talk. So it was a good translation in 1611. It's just that language has changed. The Greek text didn't change. The English language changed. So the correct translation, and the point Peter is making is, you've talked to him. He's rejected it. Don't continue. Back off. Be silent. Let your life have an impact on him. You're winning by your conduct, not by your conversation. He says, without a word. My point is that there's a time to speak and there's a time to be silent. So after you've talked to a person and they've gotten the message, don't continue. Just the continuing over and over, hammering the point, is in itself brutal. And that's what his friends did, and that's what we should not do. All right, how do you handle that? Have you ever been beat up verbally by a friend? Some of you are shaking your head, you know what I'm talking about. How do you handle that? All right, we're gonna look at see how Job handled it, and I think there is an extremely valuable lesson here. So I want us to notice carefully how Job handles this. So let's go back to the book of Job, this time at the beginning of chapter 21. As compared to the other speeches of Job himself, this one is unusual. It's unusual because he confines his remarks to just his friends. In the other speeches, he sometimes talked about himself. He very often talked to the Lord or about the Lord. In this speech, he goes straight after his friends, and he's going after all three of them at the same time. That's not immediately obvious from the English text, but in the Hebrew text, these words are often in the plural, indicating he's addressing all three friends. So they're standing by, and they're listening to all of this. All three of them are there. There may be a fourth friend standing by. That's a good possibility. We'll get to him later. But at any rate, here's what Job says. Listen to me. Verse 1. Then Job answered and said, listen carefully to my speech and let this be your consolation. He says, bear with me that I may speak. And after I've spoken, keep mocking. As for me, verse 4. Is my complaint against man? And if it were, why should I not be impatient? He's saying my principal difficulty is not with you, it's with God. It's not so much what you have said, it's what God has done to me. So he's saying in these opening verses, listen to me, bear with me, hear me. And then he says, and look at me. Look at verse 5. Look at me and be astonished. Put your hands over your mouth. Isn't that a vivid way to say it? Look at my disease-ridden body. Just look. So in the first couple of verses, he said, listen, listen, listen. Now he says, look. I was looking at this and I thought, I haven't heard of this in a long time. When you come up to a train track, you're supposed to do what? Stop, look, and listen. That's basically what he's saying. Stop, look, and listen. And be astonished at what you see. Put your hand over your mouth. In other words, you be quiet, which is what I just said. He concludes this introduction by saying, even when I remember, I am terrified, and trembling takes hold of my flesh. When I remember what I go through, I shudder. So this is sort of his introduction, a simple request that they hear him. By the way, Patricia and I decided many years ago, most people just want to be heard. They just want to be heard. Matter of fact, she and I thought once, we ought to start a business that we'll just listen. We won't condemn. We won't judge. We'll just listen. You know, $50 an hour talk. Would that be a great business? In the last week, I saw an article where a psychologist in San Francisco has started that free. They set up two chairs on the sidewalk and a little sign that says, we'll just listen. And somebody sits in a chair and just listens. And you can come and sit down the chair and pour out your soul. You know, they say this is not therapy. I'm not so sure of that. I think there's some therapeutic value into just being heard. And Job is saying, just hear me. I want you to just look at what's going on in my body and listen to me. Then he comes out swinging. I envision this as a boxing match, and Zophar looks like he was winning, but Job hadn't even gotten started. So beginning in verse 7, he refutes Zophar point by point. The first thing he says is, you've been claiming that the wicked don't prosper, and if they do, it won't last long. Well, I'm here to tell you, the wicked prosper. Why do the wicked live and become old? Remember, you said that life was going to be brief. Well, I know wicked people who are old. They become mighty in power. He's arguing that the wicked don't die young, like you said. Their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. Job's friends have argued that the children of the wicked would be cut off. Job responds that the children of the wicked are often established before the very eyes of their parents, meaning their parents live long enough to see them get married, to see them have children, to see them succeed in a career. He's just refuting what they say. Furthermore, he says in verse 9, their houses are safe from fear. Neither is the rod of God upon them. Zophar argued that the house of the wicked is not safe. They themselves have no peace, that they are judged by God. Job's response is that their houses are often safe and God does not judge them. They live in safety and security. So he is arguing in verse 10, their bull breeds without failure, and their cows, calves, without miscarriage. In other words, the wicked do prosper. What you're saying is simply not true. Look at verse 11. They send forth their little ones like a flock, and their children dance. It's not that their children die. The children of the wicked may not be bad off at all. They aren't. Remember what Zophar said? They're going to be so bad off, they're going to be begging at the poor people. Remember that? Well, Job comes back and says, I know wicked people whose children go to the dance. And look like me, they're begging from the poor. You see what he's doing? He's answering him tit for tat. Verse 12, they sing to the trampoline and harp and rejoice to the sound of the flute. They spend their days in wealth and in a moment go down to the grave. He's talking about the wicked and their children. But he acknowledges that the wicked reject God. Look at verse 14. Yet they say to God, depart from us, for we do not desire knowledge of your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we have if we pay to him? So Job is arguing, the wicked prosper, yet they tell God to leave them alone because they don't want to have anything to do with him. They don't desire to serve him or pray to him. And yet, many people who do not know God or reject him live peaceable, pleasant lives. That is his point. He says it, verse 16, indeed, the prosperity is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. The prosperity of the wicked is not in their hands. That is, their prosperity does not come ultimately from their own hands. It is provided by the God they scorn. Job's view is based on the fact that the Lord gives and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So his point in verses 7 to 16 is that even though they reject God, they prosper, which is the opposite of what you have been saying. He continues this refutation in verse 17. How often are the wicked destroyed? How often is the lamp of the wicked put out? How often does the destruction come upon them? The sorrow of God distributes in his anger. Bildad claimed, the light of the wicked indeed goes out, and the flame of his fire does not shine. Job is saying, and how often does that happen? You've exaggerated the case, guys. They are like straw before the wind and like chaff that a storm carries away. The sinners are seldom blown away suddenly like straw or chaff. The wicked do not know God is punishing them. Look at verse 19. They say, God lays up one's iniquity for his children. Let him compensate him that he may know it. Job's friends, they said God punishes children for the sins of their fathers. Job's rejoinder is, if God punishes his children for the father's sin, he ought to at least tell them that's what's happening, because they don't get it. Let their eyes see his destruction, and let him drink the wrath of the Almighty. God should let the wicked see the destruction of their children with their own eyes. Let them experience God's wrath, but that isn't what happens. For what does he care about his household after him, and the number of the mouths is cut in half? After a man dies, he doesn't see what happens to his descendants. Can anyone teach God knowledge since he judges those on high? Can anyone teach God how to deal with people since he's the one that rules over the great affairs of the universe? But this is the way life is, and God is running it. Who's going to be his teacher? People die in different ways, verse 23. One dies in full strength, being wholly at ease and secure. Pails are full of milk, and the marrow of his bones is moist. In response to Zophar's comment about the wicked dying with his bones full of youthful vigor, Job says one man dies peacefully when he's healthy and prosperous. Another man dies, he says in verse 25, in the bitterness of his soul and never having eaten with pleasure. Having never seen or eaten in pleasure, he has been derived of that pleasure, and consequently he is bitter. They lie down alike in the dust, and the worms cover them. Both men that he've described die alike. One is buried with the once buried, the worms cover them. So he says in verse 27, look, I know your thoughts, and the schemes with which you have wronged me? For you say, where is the house of the prince? And where in the tent, the dwelling place of the wicked? Job knows what they're thinking. He knows the schemes that they use against him. He is aware of how they might answer him. So he says in verse 29, have you not answered or asked those who travel the road? Do you not know their signs? He anticipates their question by asking a question. He asked them if they've ever asked people who travel, do you know the signs of travel? In other words, if Job's friend inquired of well-traveled people, they would learn that in every part of the world, wicked people seem to escape the calamities that sometime befall the righteous. It's the opposite of what you've been telling me so far. For the wicked are reserved for the day of doom. They should be brought out on the day of wrath. Just go ask travelers. They've learned that the wicked are not punished at once, but they're kept, that's the key to verse 30, with a view to future punishment. Who condemns his ways to his face, and who repays him for what he has done? In other words, Job adds, who personally confronts, condemns, and carries out the punishment of the wicked for what they've done. The point is, none would dare do it. The wicked man are not punished according to their character here. It's reserved for a day of future wrath. Yet he should be brought to the grave and a vigil kept over his tomb. The clods of the valley shall be sweet to him. Everyone shall follow him as countless have gone before him. The wicked may enjoy the honors of a beautiful tomb. A crowd follows his casket in the funeral procession. How then can you comfort me with these empty words, since falsehood remains in your answers? How could you possibly give me hope or comfort with empty words that contain lies? Job is saying, I have proven by fact and testimony that your positions are false and unfounded. Your pretense to comfort me are as hollow as the arguments you bring in support of your doctrines. So he refutes the arguments of his friend by pointing that the wicked are destroyed, not often destroyed, that they do not know God, I should say, and that God is punishing them. So Job refutes Zophar point by point. His assertion is that the wicked experience calamity because of the judgment of God. By pointing out that wicked men prosper, they do not necessarily suffer calamity and judgment. All right. I know we went through a lot of verses real fast, but the point is real simple. And the point is simply this. Job answers Zophar and his other friends point by point. He calmly and rationally takes all of their points as if he wrote them down, and he answers them one by one. So I want to close by making two suggestions. I ask at the beginning, have you ever been brutalized by a friend who is attacking you verbally? How do you handle that? Well, as I have said before in this series, and will say again, when you are being attacked, that's emotional, and you tend to respond emotionally. If not at the moment, later. Ever been there? Ever done that? And when you get emotional, you say things you later wish you had never said, right? So here's the first lesson. When brutally attacked by a friend, refute their arguments rationally. Stay calm and answer them rationally. Now just imagine what Job was going through. Do you think he was having some pain, physical, emotional, psychological? Wow, absolutely. Though his suffering, pain,
and emotion were intense. He rationally thought through the material hurled at him and responded with a thoughtful response. Someone has said, this speech explains Job's position, which certainly squares with reality better than the ones his advocates advanced. Frequently, the wicked do prosper throughout their lives. God does not always cut off evil people prematurely. For example, even though Manasseh was Judah's worst king, he reigned the longest. Even though Mussolini and Hitler died violent deaths, Lenin and Stalin died in their own beds as old men. Furthermore, all that desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Job accuses his friends of just being dead wrong. But he does it calmly and rationally. He doesn't get emotional. He just answers them point by point. Now, at this juncture, if this is all there were to the book, I think I would have to say that Job wins the day. When I was in high school, I was a member of the debate squad. And when I was in college, I was a member of the debate squad. I love a good debate. Did me a great disservice when I got in the ministry. I love debate. And I had to learn you don't do that. However, I've even judged debates. And if I were going to say, they're going at it hot and heavy. And at this juncture, I would say, just listening to them, that Job makes more sense. Would you agree? I mean, to say that, you know, wickedness causes suffering and wicked people die and wicked people don't prosper. Job has answered them. He's answered them. And I would have to say, if I were grading this debate or boxing match, Job gets the majority of the points so far. Let me make a second observation, and this is the one I walk away with from Job's answer more than any other. Job answered his friends point by point. So I think the principle here is, when you're brutally attacked by a friend and you care to answer him rationally and point by point. Now, I don't know that this applies in every case. I think there may be some exceptions. I'm not trying to make a law out of this. I'm trying to make a principle out of it. But I think there is a time and a place that when you are accused of outlandish things that are not true, and you are right, that there is a place to say, here is my case, and take the arguments and answer them one by one. That, if we time to analyze this carefully, is exactly what Job did. As I was going through the passage, I kept pointing out, he's answering Zophar, he's answering all three friends, he's answering what they said. He did it point by point, and that's why I think he won. And that's what I'm recommending you do in some cases. After practicing law and serving in the Navy during World War II, in 1946, he was elected to the House of Representatives, where he made a name for himself in the Un-American Activities Committee. In 1950, he was elected to the United States Senate. In 1952, at the Republican National Convention, Richard Nixon was chosen by President candidate Dwight Eisenhower to be his running mate. 2 months later, the New York Post ran the headline, quote, "Secret Rich Man's Trust Fund Keeps Nixon in Style Far Beyond His Salary," end of quote. The article claimed that campaign donors were buying influence with Nixon by keeping a secret fund stocked with cash for his personal expenses. They specifically accused him of pocketing $18,000. By the way, that was in 1952. Today, that would be roughly somewhere around $140,000, a sizable sum. So, outrage followed. Many Republicans urged Eisenhower to take Nixon off the ticket. On September 23, 1952, Nixon appeared on national television from the El Capitan Theater in Hollywood to defend himself. He answered the charges point by point. He said that his funds, the fund did exist, but the money wasn't secret, was strictly covered by strictly used to cover campaign expenses, and no contributor to the campaign ever received any special treatment. He produced the results of an independent audit of his finances and the proceeds to demonstrate the financial history, touching on everything from money he made in speaking engagements to the rent he paid for an apartment in Virginia for 4 years, which, by the way, was $80 a month. I thought you'd appreciate that. To a $10 check he received from a supporter too young to vote that he promised never to cash. He listed all of his income, which he'd made outside of his salary, since entering public life. He itemized his debts, giving the dollar amount of each one. He said that he did not own any stocks, bonds, or an interest in any business. He had a $4,000 insurance policy on his life, against which he had borrowed $500. It was a detailed, point-by-point answer to the charges against him. I heard that speech a couple of years ago, and I was trying to figure out, when have I ever seen anybody give a point-by-point answer to somebody? And I woke up in the middle of the night, and this came to me, and I Googled it. You can go hear the speech online. I listened to it again. On YouTube, you can even see him delivering it. It is a very powerful speech. He ends it by pointing out that there was one contribution that he admitted to receiving and keeping for himself. A man named Luke Carroll, a traveling salesman for Texas, had heard Nixon's wife mention during a radio interview how much the Nixon children wanted a dog. So he sent them a black and white spotted American Cocker Spaniel that Nixon's daughter Trish named Checkers. Nixon admitted that that could become an issue, but he said he didn't care. His kids loved the dog, and no matter what his critic says, he was going to keep the dog. That speech became known as the Checkers speech, named after the dog, who, by the way, lived till 1964 and was buried in a dog cemetery. It's amazing what you can find out on Google. It was a great success. Nixon gained sympathy from both the public and from the powerful Republicans who had been calling for his head. Eisenhower summons Nixon to West Virginia and greeted him at the airport with the words, "Dick, you're my boy." Eisenhower and Nixon defeated the Democrats in November by 7 million votes. Richard Nixon saved his political career by answering critics point by point. Now, he destroyed it later with a lie, but that's another story. The point is, there is a time when you should answer your critics point by point. That's what Job did. And that's the kind of thing that we should do in some situations. Let's pray. Father, thank you for giving us this complex, long discussion between Job and his friends. And help us to learn from it, so that we can emulate what a good friend does and how a friend responds when he's being attacked. Grant us that grace. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.